Welcome to Learning English, America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Jill Robbins, Dan Friedel, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Jill Robbins.
Japanese railway company Tokyu says it now uses only renewable energy to power its train operations. That means Tokyu's huge network of train lines in and around Tokyo do not produce any carbon dioxide emissions. The change took place April 1st. Tokyu employs 3,855 people and connects Tokyo with the nearby city of Yokohama. It has more than 100 kilometers of railway tracks, serving 2.2 million people a day. It is the first railroad operator in Japan to have reached the goal of zero carbon emissions. It says the carbon dioxide reduction is equal to the yearly average emissions of 56,000 Japanese households. Nicholas Little is director of railway education at Michigan State University. He praised Tokyu for supporting renewable energy. But he noted it is also important to improve ways of creating renewable energy. The bigger impacts come from increasing electricity generation from renewable sources, Little said. The long-term battle is to increase production of renewable electricity. So, is Tokyo's move to renewables just a campaign for good publicity? Or is the company moving in the right direction for the environment? There is no simple answer, says one expert. Ryo Takagi is a professor at Kogakuin University and specialist in electric railway systems. He says bigger environmental gains would come from changing rural operations from diesel fuel to hydrogen power or switching to electric automobiles. Tokyo's action is better than nothing, but Takagi said, I am not going out of my way to praise it as great. Tokyu official Yoshimasa Kitano says the company plans more action toward cleaner operations. We don't see this as reaching our goal, but just a start, Kitano said. Such steps are critical for Japan, the world's sixth biggest carbon polluter. The country has a goal of becoming carbon neutral by the year 2050. About 20% of Japan's electricity comes from renewable sources, says Japan's Institute for Sustainable Energy Policies. That is far behind New Zealand, for example, where 84% of power used comes from renewable energy sources. New Zealand hopes to make that 100% by 2035. The renewable sources driving Tokyu trains include hydropower, geothermal power, wind power, and solar power. That information comes from Tokyo Electric Power Company, the utility that provides the electricity and looks at its energy sourcing. Since Japan's 2011 nuclear disaster in Fukushima, the country has shut down most of its nuclear plants and increased use of coal-fired power plants. Japan aims to have 36-38% of its energy come from renewable sources by 2030. I'm Jill Robbins.
Salar de Uyuni is a world-famous area of Bolivia. The extremely dry land is flat and white and covered with salt from the earth. Many visitors visit the special place each year. A young boy is having fun by taking unusual pictures of all the visitors with a little help from a toy dinosaur. 11-year-old Peter Condori takes photos of visitors standing on the salt flats and places the small dinosaur in a part of the frame. He does it in a way that makes it look as if the toy is running toward the people. The white sand permits the boy to play with perspective. In other words, he can make the people look small and the toy look large. He also uses things like an empty glass bottle to make it look as if the visitors are being poured out of the bottle. Condori charges the visitors, or tourists, a little bit of money for each photo. At the end of each day, he takes home about $15 to help his family pay for food or to help his brothers and sisters buy toys. Food prices have shot up recently, making it harder for Peter's family to buy everything it needs. Peter's father, Diego, works in the salt business. "We didn't even have enough money to eat," Diego said, noting that it was hard for his business during the COVID-19 pandemic. Peter's mother sells handmade art to the salt flats visitors. His brothers and sisters help too. Diego Condori said his family had a small amount of money saved, but that money ran out during the last 2 years. "We have dedicated ourselves to working in tourism as a family," Diego said. The Condori family is the same as many others in Bolivia. The South American nation depends strongly on tourism. The 2,000 people who work in tourism have asked the government to remove some COVID-19-related restrictions. One Bolivian tourism organization said visitors have decreased by 90%. I'm Dan Friedel.
Scientists say they have identified the two largest Mars quakes ever recorded on the Red Planet. A Mars quake is a seismic event that happens on Mars. It is similar to earthquakes that happen on our planet. The activity was recorded by a device called a seismometer. It is attached to the InSight lander, a spacecraft operated by the American Space Agency, NASA. The seismometer was designed to be extremely sensitive for the Martian environment. It aims to differentiate between seismic signals coming from inside Mars and activity coming from above the surface, such as wind or meteorite movements. One of the Mars quakes happened on August 25, 2021. It had a magnitude of 4.2. The other, on September 18, 2021, measured 4.1. An international team led by researchers from Britain's University of Bristol confirmed the seismic activity. The findings were recently reported in a study in the publication The Seismic Record. A Mars quake happens when soil on Mars is subjected to a buildup of pressure so great that it leads rock structures to break, explains ETH Zurich. ETH Zurich is a public research university in Zurich, Switzerland. Researchers from the university took part in the latest study. The InSight lander brought the first seismometer to Mars in late 2018. It recorded its first Mars quake in April 2019. Since then, it has recorded hundreds of Mars quakes. But examinations of the two reported in the study suggest they were the largest yet to hit Mars. The researchers said the two Mars quakes were 5 times stronger than any others recorded before. They were also the first seismic events to happen on the planet's far side from where the InSight lander sits. The study notes that as of October 2021, records from InSight included nearly 1,000 seismic events. All of those happened on the side of Mars where the spacecraft operates, in an area called Elysium Planitia. NASA says that area sits just north of Mars' equator and is the second largest volcanic area on the planet. As the seismic activity was still being studied, NASA noted in a statement last September that it appeared the 4.2 Mars quake happened about 8,500 kilometers from the InSight lander. Both large Mars quakes happened in an area known as the Core Shadow Zone, said a statement by the Seismological Society of America. That is a part of Mars where some kinds of seismic waves cannot travel directly to InSight's seismometer. This is because the waves get blocked or are otherwise affected by the planet's core. The waves instead get reflected at least once at the surface before traveling to the seismometer, the Society statement said. Recording events within the core shadow zone is a real stepping stone for our understanding of Mars, said Savas Selan, a researcher with ETH Zurich who helped lead the study. He added that the energy that travels within the core shadow of Mars has never been seismologically studied before. The researchers say such seismic wave data can help them learn more about deeper layers within Mars, as well as the planet's current seismic activity. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to the Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. We begin the story of Bill Clinton, America's 42nd president. He led the United States for 8 years from January of 1993 to January of 2001. Our story begins in 1991. In February of that year, American-led forces won Operation Desert Storm to end Iraqi occupation of Kuwait. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein considered Kuwait a province of Iraq. He had invaded the oil-rich country in August 1990. Coalition airstrikes began 4 months later in January against Iraqi targets. The ground war took place in February and lasted just 4 days. The American-led victory in the Gulf War added to the popularity of President George H.W. Bush. 1991 was also the last year for the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. The collapse of the Soviet Union brought an end to more than 40 years of Cold War tensions and fears of nuclear war. In the United States, attention was turning to the 1992 presidential election. Many political observers believed President Bush would easily win a second term. But the economy was not doing much to help his chances. The United States went through a serious recession that lasted 8 months, from July 1990 to March 1991. Unemployment rose to the highest level in years. At the same time, the federal government was deeply in debt after years of borrowing. Bush was a Republican. Democrats saw his falling popularity as a good opportunity to retake the White House. They placed their hopes on William Jefferson Clinton. At the time, he was the young governor of the southern state of Arkansas. He was gaining national attention by talking about issues like education. Bill Clinton was born on August 19, 1946, in the small town of Hope, Arkansas. His name at birth was William Jefferson Blythe. His father, also named William Jefferson Blythe, was a traveling salesman. He died in a car accident 3 months before his son was born. At the age of two, the boy was sent to live with his grandparents while his mother, Virginia Blythe, studied to become a nurse. She married a man named Roger Clinton when her son was four. The family moved to Hot Springs, Arkansas. When he was 15, William Jefferson Blythe legally changed his name to William Jefferson Clinton. His stepfather drank too much and was sometimes abusive to him, his mother, and his stepbrother, Roger Jr. But Bill Clinton did well in school. He also developed a strong early interest in politics and ran for student offices in high school. In 1963, while still in high school, Bill Clinton went to Washington as a delegate to a Boys Nation program for young leaders. There, he got to meet President John F. Kennedy. Years later, Richard Stratton, who was president of Boys Nation in 1963, remembered that meeting.
It was a beautiful, bright summer day. It was July 24, 1963. And we were all assembled in the Rose Garden at the White House as a group, waiting for the president to come out. We all sat there, riveted in attention.
We want to welcome you to the White House, particularly because this belongs to all of you and because it's so intimately connected with the best in American history.
I was about the third or fourth person in. And he started here, and I sort of muscled my way up and made sure I got to shake hands with the president. He was quite generous. He went down the line and shook hands with a pretty good number of us who were there that night. It had a very profound impact on me. I think that, you know, it's something that I carried with me always, and I was very fortunate that someone took a picture of it and gave it to me, so I was always able to remember it.
Right after that frame, the famous frame of him shaking hands with JFK, there's another picture from the same film showing President Kennedy shaking hands with Jeff Keyes, another one of our boys, him from Florida, and Bill Clinton looking down at his hand with this wonderful look like I'll never wash it again.
Bill Clinton went on to study at Georgetown University in Washington. He graduated in 1968 and won a Rhodes Scholarship to attend Oxford University in England. He spent 2 years there before entering Yale Law School in New Haven, Connecticut. There, he met another law student, Hillary Rodham. She was from just outside Chicago, and she shared his deep interest in politics and public service. They both graduated in 1973. Bill Clinton returned to Arkansas. Hillary Rodham went on to become a lawyer involved in the congressional investigation of the Watergate scandal. That case led to the resignation of President Richard Nixon in 1974. That same year, Bill Clinton, a Democrat, ran for Congress in Arkansas. He lost the close race to a popular Republican. A year later, he and Hillary Rodham married. And a year after that, in 1976, Arkansas voters elected him Attorney General, the state's top law enforcement officer. In 1978, Bill Clinton ran for governor and easily won. He became, at the age of 32, the state's youngest governor ever. While Bill Clinton was governor, the federal government operated a detention center in Arkansas for Cuban refugees. The refugees rioted. That rioting hurt Bill Clinton politically when he ran for re-election. His opponent argued that he should have done more to get the government to hold the Cubans someplace else. Also, Clinton had supported unpopular new taxes. In 1980, Bill Clinton was defeated in his campaign for a second term as governor of Arkansas. But he regained the office in the next election 2 years later. That was before the term of office was increased from 2 years to 4 years. Clinton went on to serve as governor of Arkansas until 1992. While he was governor, education in the state improved. More students finished high school, and more went on to college. The state increased requirements for teachers and also increased their pay. Governor Clinton also expanded early learning programs for children from poor families. While governor, Bill Clinton also became active in Democratic Party leadership at the national level.
Make no mistake, this election is about change. Change in our party, change in our leadership, change in our nation. And that is why today I proudly announce my candidacy for President of the United States of America.
In 1991, Bill Clinton announced that he would run for the Democratic nomination for president. His main opponents were Paul Tsongas and Jerry Brown. Tsongas was a former senator from Massachusetts. Brown had been governor of California. Paul Tsongas later withdrew, and Bill Clinton easily defeated Jerry Brown for the nomination. Democrats held their national nominating convention in New York City in July 1992.
And so,
In the name of all those who do the work, pay the taxes, raise the kids, and play by the rules. In the name of the hardworking Americans who make up our forgotten middle class, I proudly accept your nomination for President of the United States.
Bill Clinton chose Senator Al Gore of Tennessee as his running mate for vice president. The Republicans nominated President Bush and Vice President Dan Quayle for a second term. Another candidate in the 1992 presidential election was a Texas businessman named Ross Perot. He competed as an independent, a so-called third-party candidate. His choice for vice president was James Stockdale, a former high-level Navy officer and pilot. He had been shot down and held as a prisoner of North Vietnam for 7 years. During the campaign, Ross Perot argued that neither of the major candidates was taking the national debt seriously enough. He also warned of the loss of American jobs.
To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element in making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south.
Bill Clinton criticized President Bush for not doing more about the economy and unemployment. Bush pointed out that the Democrats controlled Congress, and he said the Democrats had defeated most of his proposals. The president also talked about his foreign policy successes, and most famously, he promised not to raise taxes.
My opponent won't rule out raising taxes, but I will, and the Congress will push me to raise taxes, and I'll say no, and they'll push again, and I'll say, read my lips. No new taxes.
But raise taxes he did, and many Americans remembered that on Election Day. Bill Clinton and Al Gore won the 1992 election. They received about 45 million votes, or 6 million more than President Bush and Vice President Quayle. Ross Perot and James Stockdale received close to 20 million, or 19% of the popular vote. Bill Clinton became America's 42nd president on January 20, 1993. At the age of 46, he was the third youngest person ever elected president. At his inauguration, the new president said there was no longer a division between foreign and domestic issues.
The world economy, the world environment, the world AIDS crisis, the world arms race, they affect us all. Today, as an old order passes, the new world is more free but less stable. Communism's collapse has called forth old animosities and new dangers. Clearly, America must continue to lead the world we did so much to make.
But even as he took office, critics were questioning Clinton's character. There had been accusations during the campaign about relationships with other women in Arkansas. And there were questions about an investment that he and Hillary Clinton had made in a land development project back in 1978.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.